Illinois faces some big challenges. Today, you're about to hear a truly honest analysis of the problems we face. Equally important, you'll also hear an in-depth discussion of some practical solutions. This is your radio source for stories, insight, and the answers you won't hear anywhere else. Not in the media, and not coming from Springfield. You're listening to Illinois Rising, presented by the Illinois Policy Institute. Now, here's your host, Dan Proft.
Dan Proft and Christina Rasmussen, guest hosting on this edition of Illinois Rising. Christina Rasmussen, Executive Vice President at the Illinois Policy Institute. Christina, great to have you.
Thanks for having me on.
So budget is, or the lack thereof, is the big topic of conversation, particularly up against the end of the fiscal year, the end of this month. And Illinois State Comptroller Leslie Munger has put out a very compelling internet meme to try and understand Illinois' finances in a way that is similar to how you would understand your household budget if you were in similar peril. So here's how she paints the picture. You have $7,000 in bills on your kitchen table. You have $2,000 in bills in your mailbox. You have $110,000 in credit card debt, and you have $100 in your bank account. Make that work. Difficult. Difficult to make that work, wouldn't you say?
It is. She doesn't have a very enviable job, but she's doing a great job at it, trying to keep things moving as much as she possibly can.
Well, that's a perfect segue to have Illinois State Comptroller Leslie Munger join us now. Leslie, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on.
So how are you managing to make that impossible math work, at least up until this juncture?
Well, I have to say it's getting trickier the longer this goes on. We currently have about $7.4 billion in bills in the state right now, and we're paying bills back from March 31st, so we're running about 10 weeks behind. And it's especially concerning because we just went through our highest revenue period in the state, having just gone through our income tax receipts. So it's definitely getting more difficult.
But Comptroller, you did an amazing thing a while back. You decided to put legislator paychecks at the back of the line, so we're spending on other priorities first. Tell us a little bit about how that has gone over.
Well, with most of the people in the state who I talk to, they are extremely happy and very supportive that we're all finally walking in the same shoes. And really, I did it as a result of traveling all around the state, talking to organizations, and really feeling increasingly bad that I was prioritizing payments, essentially, to the General Assembly and to myself and the other elected officials in the state. Just really felt so wrong when everyone else was waiting so many months for payment. And I think, you know, this is a great way for us to say we're all in this together and we all got to work together to get a solution. But I will tell you privately, I have had many conversations with individual legislators who are very angry at me, who are complaining because it's been 6, now 8 weeks that they haven't had a paycheck, and they're wondering how they're going to pay their mortgage. And I said, you know, I tell them, at least you have a job. You know, at least you will get paid. You are in line. And what about the organizations that we have not been able to pay all year? So it certainly, I think, has been a wake-up call to many of them, the condition of the situation in the state.
When you have state legislators come to you and complain about not being paid, I'd suggest you just tell them to cry you a river. The reason the state is in the peril it is, where you don't have the money to pay not just legislators, but more important organizations and enterprises, is because of the job they haven't done.
Well, you know, I do try to explain that to them, Dan, in maybe slightly more nice terms.
Yes, well,
you're a nicer person than Dan.
I'm not particularly pleasant, yes, yes.
I say, you know, we have $7 billion of bills right now in-house that we cannot pay. And every time we pass more legislation without the funding that goes with it, we add to that. And so just promising money without the money to actually pay the bill doesn't help anyone. And I think they're starting to get the message because they're seeing it hit their own checkbooks. And I remind them that this is a result of 15 plus years of unbalanced budgets. And eventually you run out of money and we're out.
We do run out of money. So Dan just mentioned a couple of moments ago that we're bumping up to the end of the fiscal year. July 1 will be the start of the next fiscal year. Help us understand the importance of this upcoming date and what it means for ordinary taxpayers.
Well, for most of the people in the state, a lot of organizations have been receiving funds at this point because we're running the state based on court orders and consent decrees, but also based on a number of ad hoc legislation that was passed throughout the year by the governor and the legislature. And when we get to the new fiscal year and without a budget in place, all that legislation that allows us to pay our local governments, 911 services, that allowed us back in April to send out checks, some money to the universities and students waiting for MAP grants, that are allowing us, the lottery that people will remember last fall, there was such an uproar about that. All that legislation goes away, we start from ground zero again. So, and probably the biggest concern that will hit just about every family in the state is our schools are not funded yet this year. Last year, there was a standalone budget bill that went through. It was the only thing the governor signed from last year's budget that allowed us to fund the schools. And this year, nothing has been passed to fund the schools yet coming out of the legislature. And that means that we'll be on, if nothing is passed before the end of July, beginning of August, we'll be able to open a lot of our schools on time, and teacher pensions will not be funded. The funding for teacher pensions is actually also in that bill.
Well, I mean, if they do a stopgap budget, say, that gets us through the end of the calendar year, then we're going to borrow another $500 million. We've got a bond sale set for the summer, a little over $500 million, and you've got the court decrees in terms of who gets paid and which order of priority. And so why can't we just continue on like this in perpetuity if most Illinoisans aren't seeing this impact their daily lives?
Well, I think they will see it impact their daily lives because the situation with our universities is not getting any better. Anyone who's got a student going off to college is going to see, in the state of Illinois anyway, we'll see some changes this year. We significantly underfunded our universities last year. We paid them $600 million. I think we owe them another $1.3 billion from last year. And then we have funding for this year on hold as a result of no budget. So a number of our universities in the state will be definitely challenged in going forward in the fall. And I think really the biggest thing is the more we go on without a budget, the more we overspend the resources that we have in the state, the longer that backlog of bills gets, and the harder it is for us to meet the promises, complete the promises that we made to the people and the organizations all throughout the state. Many people in the state have friends or relatives who rely on some of the social services, whether it's for the elderly or for child care or for developmentally disabled. The organizations that serve our most vulnerable have really had a hard time this year. Many of them are still waiting for payments from the state. Some of them we've been unable to pay all year because they fall into the unfunded part of the government. And so, you know, really we're at a point now, as we continue to run the state without a budget, that there are organizations throughout the state, whether it's businesses that provide services to state organizations like our correctional centers, those organizations provide food and not been paid all year. So small businesses are hurting, social services are hurting, our universities, education system is hurting, and we keep spending money we do not have. And we need a budget that sets priorities, that makes decisions about what we are going to fund and how we are going to fund it, so we can begin to live within our means and we can keep the promises that we've made.
We're talking to Illinois State Comptroller Leslie Munger. And Leslie, Mark Glennon in Wider Point sent an interesting piece last month where he suggested that the state treasurer's office, Mr. Frerichs' office, has about $11.5 billion in state money called the state portfolio that's invested in bank accounts, securities, earning an average of a little over 0.5% per year. Now, he points out some of this money is set aside for specific uses, but some of it isn't. Is this money that could be accessed?
You know, I have. We started to look into that, and to be honest, I don't know yet how much of that is available. Some of this money is required to pay obligations that are already, that the state already has, and some of that money is, I think, part of the money that is being considered for some of the fund sweeps, et cetera. To be honest, though, I don't know. We are looking into it, but I don't have access to all that information at this point.
Quick question. You know, you just described a lot of the core government services that vulnerable populations in Illinois rely on. Human services, for example. You talked about higher education in our universities, state workers who want to get paid. I have a lot of liberal friends who are absolutely horrified that Illinois state government and the legislature has not gotten around to finally funding these things. And they look at the General Assembly and they say, we don't understand. Democrats have a supermajority control of both the House and the Senate. They say they care about these vulnerable populations, yet they're not passing a budget, and they are genuinely horrified. You know, what would you tell those people out there who genuinely do want to see government fund these activities, but yet see them being held hostage for apparent political purposes?
Well, you really, I think, hit the nail on the head, Christina. There are people who have put politics ahead of the good of the state and the good of the taxpayers in the state for a long time. And I think the fact that this year the Senate and the House did not pass anything, that the Senate did not just rubber stamp what the House sent them, which was a budget bill that was $7.5 billion overspent, certainly it makes it clear that even those in the legislature are starting to understand that we cannot continue down the same road.
We now return to Illinois Rising, presented by the Illinois Policy Institute, the radio show discussing the honest truth about Illinois policy and politics. Here's Dan Proft.
Dan Proft back with Christina Rasmussen, Executive Vice President of the Illinois Policy Institute. On this edition of Illinois Rising, you can catch my act with Amy Jacobson as well, as you do on this show, on Monday through Friday, 5 a.m. to 9 a.m. Yeah, 9 p.m. That would be a long show. 4-hour morning drive show with Amy Jacobson called Chicago's Morning Answer. And Christina, one of the issues that Governor Rauner has made part of his turnaround program is workers' comp reform. Now, if you're not an employer, this is a bit of an esoteric issue. And so it's been difficult to translate for the electorate, I think. But it turns out to be a real cost savings, a real way to without jeopardizing worker safety or compensating those workers who are hurt on the job to reduce the cost of doing business in Illinois.
Absolutely. You walk onto any manufacturing floor in Illinois and you talk to management and they're trying to make this work and, you know, stop the jobs from fleeing to Indiana or out of the country. And they say, we need workers' comp reform. We need relief. We want to hire more people. We want to spend this money by giving out more jobs, not necessarily paying these overinflated costs that the Illinois state government has forced upon us. And they're crying out for relief, and they have been for some years, and we're just not seeing the change out of Springfield that they deserve.
And it's one of these things where relief, lowering the cost of people doing business, would be a better way to go, perhaps, than subsidizing people to locate their jobs here. I mean, all you're doing is essentially conceding that the cost of doing business in Illinois is too high, so we're going to give you money to come here to locate your business, to grow jobs. But we would achieve the same thing without transferring money from somebody's pocket to somebody else's pocket if we just reduce the cost.
Absolutely. And instead of giving out crony deals that benefit a few companies who happen to have a good lobbyist and good connections, you could treat everyone fairly and make Illinois just a more generally well-liked place to do business.
The fairness argument. Yeah, that's a good one. Zach Model, he's the chief alignment officer of Atlas Tool and Die Works in Lyons. There in West Central Cook County, and he knows what it's like to deal with the workers' comp system in Illinois because he runs a manufacturing company. And Zach joins us now. Zach, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Oh, thanks for having me, Dan. Great to be here.
So just kind of explain from your first-person account what the impact of the current workers' comp regime is in Illinois and perhaps in comparison to other states to the extent that you can compare and contrast, and what some kind of reform that, again, protected workers genuinely hurt on the job so that they're made whole, but also made it a little bit more competitive to be here in Illinois, particularly as a manufacturer.
Absolutely. Well, you know, from my perspective as a manufacturer, the system, it's not working here for anyone in Illinois. It's a system that's designed to protect injured workers and employers in a no-fault system and really get injured workers treated properly and back to work quickly. But what we have in Illinois, especially in a cost-effective manner, however, in Illinois, what we've got is a system that has higher costs than surrounding states and much slower outcomes. So it's not working for anyone. We're not getting injured workers back back on the job quickly. And we're doing what we are doing costs a lot more than it does in any other state around us. And so as a manufacturer, you know, we have to compete both locally, nationally, and globally. And when we have costs that are three times higher than what our competitors in other states are paying for workers' compensation, it really is a drag on our ability to grow and export more product from Illinois.
Yeah, you mentioned three times higher. I have a steel manufacturer near where I live, and he's looked at the costs in Indiana. And if he moved his company across the state line, he could cut his costs by two-thirds. It's really quite incredible. Why is it that Illinois is so much higher? I mean, surely the money is going somewhere. Where is it going, and why do we have such higher costs compared to everyone else?
Well, I think that's a great question. You know, there's been a lot of finger-pointing around the issue as to who's making all this money off of it. But I'll tell you, I've talked to companies that self-insure, and that means that they don't have an insurance company. They pool their money and save it, and when they have a claim, they pay it themselves. And some of these companies operate in multi-states. And what I've heard from these folks is that, you know, Illinois, our claims cost more. The system goes longer. You can't get an injured worker back to work. It requires more treatment to get the same exact outcome as what happens in other states. So I think we have kind of a perverse system that's been set up here in Illinois that is incentivizing the wrong kind of thing. It's incentivizing care that goes on longer and longer, and it's not incentivizing getting the worker back to work quickly. You know, and to me, you know, there's a lot of players involved in the system here, but I think we really need to address people are loath to talk about it, but the causation standard. I don't blame my injured workers for following the system through, because that's what it's set up to do. We have a system that is set up the wrong way, and we need to really look at the causation. Because right now, an injury that happens at home and an employee comes to work, if the workplace is 1% responsible, does anything to aggravate that injury, it's a workers' comp claim. That's not the right way to have it here in Illinois.
Yeah, that's the one of the issues is kind of the gaming of the system. And I would suggest not just the cost of it, but it probably doesn't do too much to advance employee morale if you see your colleagues gaming the system and being compensated not to work effectively. And we've heard stories, so it'd be interesting your personal experience, not just about kind of the I played basketball on the weekend and I got hurt and then I went to work and I got hurt a little bit more, or I just claimed that what happened playing basketball over the weekend actually happened on the job, and then you're embroiled in this back and forth in the workers' comp system, or even going so far as, you know, people injuring themselves while they're under the influence of illicit substances or legal substances, but they shouldn't be under them at work. I mean, that's kind of how wild and wacky the workers' comp system is in Illinois.
You know, and it goes beyond that. We in manufacturing, we're certainly dealing with an aging workforce. You've heard about the skills gap and the shortage of manufacturing workers and skilled workers. So we have workers that are working longer and getting older and staying on the job longer. And I am seeing things that are absolutely related to the aging process being claimed as workers' comp, because you come to work and your shoulder hurts you. It's a part of the aging process, but your job aggravates it, and it goes into a workers' comp claim. And these soft tissue claims, they just go on and on and on. They're very nebulous. So it's everything you talked about. Plus, you know, our system has such a loose standard in Illinois. The workers aren't wrong. They're not gaming. They are following the law, but our law is set up so poorly in Illinois, it has absolutely no restriction for what should be for a health insurance claim versus a workers' comp claim.
I guess a better way to put it is the politicians gaming the system.
There you go. Somebody's winning off of it, Dan, but it's certainly not the employers, and it's certainly not the employees, the injured worker, either. They're definitely not benefiting.
And, of course, this is not only a manufacturing issue, right? The state government, local government, also pays work comp on its employees. And so you have taxpayers paying for these inflated work comp claims, the insurance costs. So it does directly hit everybody in this state in some form or fashion. But speaking of the laws down in Springfield, you know, work comp has finally gotten to a point where people say, okay, on the left and right, we need to do something, right? But the deal that was trying to be offered out of Springfield this spring was, okay, we'll give you a little bit of work comp reform in exchange for a massive tax increase on businesses in Illinois.
Right.
From your perspective, Zach, does that sound like a good deal, a little bit of work comp reform in exchange for a massive tax hike?
If they said a massive workers comp reform for a little tax hike, you might have my attention.
Done.
But I
deal.
Think they've got the cart in front of the horse here. But I will say this, that for manufacturers, and again, you touched on the government, you know, police, fire department, all of these people are paying workers comp. For me, in manufacturing, if we could get significant workers comp reform where we really saw our rates come down, maybe not a third, but a half, I would be saving six figures a year, and I'm a small business, and I think this and that six figures is not going to go in my pocket. I'm going to buy another machine. I'm going to buy another employer. My company is growing right now, and so are a lot of other manufacturers. We are growing. We have opportunity, and we will create the jobs and the growth, but we need an environment that supports us, and when I can move 15 minutes over the border and realize these savings that can help me grow my company, I would be foolish not to do that. So we really need the people in Illinois. It's not a D issue. It's not an R issue. It's a state of Illinois issue. We need to move beyond the politics and focus on the solutions that are going to bring us the jobs and the growth that we need.
And for manufacturers, you know, this isn't just idle chatter or an unserious threat. I mean, I assume you find colleagues in your sector that are moving 15 minutes across one of our Illinois borders to another state to reduce their cost of doing business and taking the jobs with them.
All the time. And, you know, it's not that hard to do. I don't want to do it. This is not my desire. I like being here. I love Illinois. I think it's a great state. But, you know, between property taxes and then workers' comp, there's some things that cost me six figures in a variety of areas to stay in Illinois. And, again, as a small business owner, you scratch your head and kind of say, is that making sense? And when times are tight, you know, boy, a little cushion would go a long way. So I just think I hope that the politicians in Illinois will move beyond the politics and really get some solutions done, and not just window dressing here. We need to really, in workers' compensation, get at the causation, get at some of the costs, and there are a lot of good proposals out there. People know what the answers are. We just have to move beyond the politics.
Well, a boy can dream. Zach Model, Chief Alignment Officer of Atlas Tool and Die Works in Scenic Lyons, Illinois. Zach, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate your time.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Now, more of Illinois Rising, presented by the Illinois Policy Institute, the only show directly addressing the problems and solutions for Illinois. Now, here's Dan Proft.
Dan Proft back with Christina Rasmussen, Executive Vice President of the Illinois Policy Institute, illinoispolicy.org. And Christina, Governor Rauner has successfully negotiated 18 different collective bargaining agreements with 18 different unions representing 18 different groups of state employees. But there's one that's a little bit more intransigent, and that's AFSCME, the largest state employee union, 37,000 state workers. They, where the other 18 kind of said, okay, we understand, Governor, we understand Illinois' fiscal peril, we're going to take a wage freeze, and they were able to negotiate a deal. So, I mean, Governor Rauner, for all the talk about he's anti-union, he's impractical, that stuff, he's shown he's neither of those things. But with respect to AFSCME, they want kind of a big hike in pay, and they want their contributions to pension and health care to remain the same. It tallies, depending on who you believe, somewhere between $2 and $3 billion of money we don't have. And so what is a governor to do given this situation? And it's pending in the courts now for a court to declare an impasse. And then we start to slide down a slope that could go a lot of different directions, including some kind of lockout, maybe even a general strike.
Yeah, and the governor said he's not interested in a lockout. He wants these folks to come to work and do great things for the people of Illinois. But unfortunately, we've seen AFSCME just be completely unreasonable, always wanting more, always demanding more, even though, as we heard from the comptroller earlier, Illinois is broke. And so we've kind of seen this system play out with, you know, who's going to emerge from this and get what they want. And so right now we're in a series of impasse hearings to see if, you know, if they've been negotiating for so long, but really no movement's been making. So we need to move on to the next stage. It's a really interesting time. No one's quite certain what's going to happen.
What about the prospect of a Reagan-esque moment for Governor Rauner, where he says to, you know, this version of the air traffic controllers, anybody who wants to come back to work, you're welcome back right now. This is the window. And when that window closes, I'm posting for your positions, and we're going to see if maybe there's other Illinoisans out there who'd like to make $70,000 of the guaranteed seven-figure pension and job security for life. We'll see if anybody's interested in that deal.
I think it's a pretty good deal. And I think a lot of AFSCME members in their heart of hearts know that they have a good deal, particularly in this troubled time. And so you see that the rank and file is actually much more reasonable. But unfortunately, the folks at the top controlling the union are much more extreme, and they're going to fight for every single inch. And that's why they're not conceding what they need to concede at this moment in time.
Well, for more on the legal process that gets us from where we are now to potentially those inflection points, we're now joined by Miley Smith. She is a staff attorney with the Illinois Policy Institute. Miley, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So give us an update, because I know this is with labor law, this is a process. So can you kind of give us an update in terms of where this is?
Sure. The governor asked the labor board to decide that the parties are at impasse back in January. And those proceedings have been ongoing before an administrative law judge. And those proceedings started on April 25th. They wrapped up on June 9th. And so at this point in time, there is kind of a lull. We are waiting for the state and AFSCME to file their post-hearing written arguments. And those are not due until July 13th. So we will not have a decision on the impasse from the administrative law judge until at least after that time.
So, Miley, the administrative judge hands down her ruling on July 13th. And then what are the options that the governor has, as well as AFSCME, depending on her ruling?
Well, either party can appeal to the full 5-panel board. However, a new development is that the state has asked the board to just bypass the administrative law judge and take the issue directly without waiting for the ALJ's decision.
And Miley, this really matters because we need to see cost savings now. And every month that goes by without seeing any reforms put into place for state worker compensation, we're paying for it. So,
exactly.
You know, what kind of relief could we potentially see maybe on the healthcare side if they finally expedite this so we get to a decision point?
Well, the governor's office is saying that expediting this would save the state $35 to $40 million a month in higher health costs, which is just an extraordinary amount of money that is coming out of the taxpayer's pocket.
And when you're talking about expediting the savings, expediting so they can get to some decision point.
Correct. Get to a resolution. We are still months away from resolution in this case, because once we have a decision from that 5-member panel of the state labor board, the losing party can then appeal to the state court. So it starts at the state district court all the way up to the Illinois Supreme Court. And so we're talking, even if they expedite those appeals, it could be the end of this calendar year before we have a resolution in this case.
That's incredible. A 2-year contract negotiation process. I mean, think about all the energy that this takes up, not only for the government's lawyers, the union's lawyers, but the uncertainty for state workers not knowing what kind of a deal they're going to be in, and for state taxpayers not knowing what they're going to have to pay for. I think it's time to bring this whole process to a resolution so we can move on to other important things.
Is there an opportunity, Miley, for the governor to intercede at some point before all of those appeals have been exhausted and take drastic action if he wanted to, for example, a lockout?
Well, under the tolling agreements that both of the parties signed, they have agreed that AFSCME will not strike and the governor will not lock out state workers as long as they are in this impasse proceeding. So at this point, there will not be a lockout or a strike as long as this proceeding is pending. What? Now, once the labor board, or once this comes to resolution, if this falls in favor of the governor, he can, if there is an impasse declared, he can implement his last best offer. At that point, AFSCME can strike.
Interesting. All right. Miley Smith, staff attorney with the Illinois Policy Institute. Miley, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate
Thank you. It was great.
Now, more stories, insights, and analysis of Illinois policy and politics. This is Illinois Rising, presented by the Illinois Policy Institute. Once again, your host, Dan Proft.
Dan Proft and Executive Vice President of the Illinois Policy Institute, Christina Rasmussen, joins us on this edition of Illinois Rising. And Christina, last week we discussed and we played this back and forth between State Representative Dwight Kaye, a Republican from Glen Carbon in Southern Illinois, and Mike Madigan's majority leader, State Representative Barbara Flynn Curry from Chicago, in which Dwight Kaye wanted to go kind of line item by line item through the budget. It's crazy. It's a nutty idea.
We don't do that in Illinois, apparently.
Go line item by line item and ask questions about the line items. What's this spending for? Can you explain it? Because it's just a, kind of a title and an amount. So could bear more explanation. And Barbara Flynn Curry was having none of it. She just said it's continuing appropriation or it's valuable, and that's all I have to say about it. Ditto. You were the kind of responsible party for identifying
might
that.
Have had something to do with that little clip that we got put online.
Well, that exchange has gone viral, and understandably so, because it seems like it's a microcosm of Illinois and why people are so frustrated with the political class in Springfield, because it's a nice illustration of just how little they care about your opinion and your money.
Absolutely. So I was in the gallery at the house when that exchange happened, and it was kind of otherworldly, because as I sat up in the gallery, I could tell that people in the room just thought this was a waste of time to go line by line and to ask questions about what's in the budget. But, you know, putting on my normal person hat, I realized that, oh my gosh, this is an exact microcosm of what is wrong with Illinois, the dismissiveness and contempt that they have for taxpayer dollars. So we cut that clip about 6 minutes, put it online at Facebook with the Illinois Policy Institute page, has more than 1.2 million views. And, you know, we can see stats of how long people keep watching videos for. People are watching it through all the way to the end because they just cannot believe what they're hearing and seeing. It's disgusting, quite frankly.
And you've had a number of media outlets now weigh in on this because of that exchange that kind of crystallizes the problem with the political culture in Springfield and in Illinois more generally. The Belleville News Democrat opined, the Chicago Tribune has opined. Well, kind of all saying the same thing, but the question is it getting through? Is the message getting through to the extent that people will say, okay, it's time to turn these people out and bring in some new people?
I think so, particularly when you compound the fact that this little exchange went hand in hand with a budget that was never delivered, right? So even as they went through this document, the House passed it, the Senate did not, and so there's nothing on the governor's desk. So you pair this contemptive attitude along with the fact that we don't have a budget, and people are starting to get very frustrated.
There's a survey out this week, Capital Facts, kind of an insider newsletter commissioned a poll with We Ask America, and it finds that by a fairly substantial margin, 21 points, most Illinoisans are blaming House Speaker Mike Madigan for the lack of a state budget and not Governor Rauner. That's an encouraging sign in a sense. It's also perhaps a warning sign, though, for the governor to not necessarily make this binary, but it's not me versus Madigan. It's the idea of spending money we don't have versus living within our means and starting to bring Illinois back. And it seems like that's a narrative that he's trying to offer up, and perhaps that's working more so than the mano-a-mano narrative that the Chicago and Springfield press corps want to spin.
Yeah, I think people understand that, you know, different parts of government have different roles, and it's the fundamental job of the legislature to send a budget over to the governor, right? And most people, if you don't do your job, you get fired. And so you see people saying, okay, the General Assembly, you had one job to do this spring, pass a budget, and they failed to do that. So it's really about your responsibilities that go along with your role in government, and that's why people are so upset.
Well, and it's also a bit of, let's see, who's been there forever and who's been there for 15 months? And I know the governor is the governor, and that's the top of the food chain. And there are certain responsibilities that are attended to the executive, different than even a legislative leader, even the longest serving House Speaker in the history of America at the state level, and Mike Madigan. But I think they still, even though people may be frustrated that there hasn't been as much progress as they hope, they still understand that Rauner is a reformer. And maybe they don't agree with every tactical decision he makes, but they agree with him from a dispositional perspective, and they know what Mike Madigan is, and they know he's essentially kind of the quintessential example of the problem.
Yeah, and, you know, so the session ended at the end of May, and Mike Madigan said, okay, we're going to keep talking about the budget. In fact, every Wednesday, we're going to call a special session in Springfield to keep this process moving. Well, we're now two Wednesdays in, and he's canceled both of these sessions. So in terms of, you know, making commitment and sticking to it, you're not even seeing that right now. And we're being told that maybe in the background, there's some meetings happening, some groups coming together. In the meanwhile, you know, we're ticking towards the start of that new fiscal year, and there's no budget in place.
As somebody who's in Springfield, so you're in this milieu, you talk to a lot of legislators, you have a sense of what's going on, you can read tea leaves. How does this play itself out, particularly with both sides engaged in sort of this game of brinkmanship, most particularly about money for schools so they open on time in the fall?
Absolutely. Well, I don't think any legislator wants to be tagged with the fact that their school didn't open up come August, September. So once we get closer to that date, I think you're going to see some Collar County Democrats start to say, okay, this is simply untenable. We've got to open up our schools. And you'll have, you know, conservative legislators who are ready and willing to go along with that. So we get closer to that point. I think the pressure on them to say, no thanks, Mike Madigan. I'm done with the brinkmanship. I'm going to support a reasonable compromise to get our schools open. I think you see them start to break.
But you suspect that will be a stopgap budget, not a full fiscal year budget, balanced, constitutionally balanced fiscal year budget, more of a stopgap.
Yeah, it might be a stopgap. But again, you know, maybe they fully fund one thing like schools, right? And we have the same situation where we have right now, where other things like university and human services kind of just wait around. I think everyone would agree that schools are pretty important and they need to open this fall. And so it's worth asking, why is Mike Madigan holding this up? Last year, he sent the governor an education budget. Why isn't he doing it this year?
Restoring Illinois to greatness. This is Illinois Rising, presented by the Illinois Policy Institute and hosted by Dan Prof.
Dan Prof back with Christina Rasmussen, Executive Vice President, Illinois Policy Institute, illinoispolicy.org. And Christina, Tiny Dancer, Mayor of Chicago, loves the share economy, at least for enterprises in which his brother Ari is an investor, like Uber. Not so much where Ari is not an investor, like Airbnb. He and his vice feudal lord, Brendan Riley, alderman for my ward, good old 42, they got a little persnickety with Airbnb because Airbnb launched an advertising campaign, Chicago Airwaves, saying, you know, the city is essentially trying to hold us up and sending a message to activate their customers, both in terms of those who use Airbnb and those who are the providers of accommodations via Airbnb. And this became a real point of contention because your property rights only in Chicago, as a denizen of Chicago, only extend to your payment of property taxes. And your free speech rights only extend to the point that you criticize the fifth floor.
I stayed at an Airbnb last night.
You did.
And it was fabulous. I stayed in Pilsen, very affordable. There's a convention in town, so prices at the hotels were pretty high. And to think that they would tack on an extra 4% tax on top of the lodging hotel tax, and for what? What value am I, the guest, getting out of it? What value is the host getting out of it? It's just a prop up city coffers.
Well, right. And I mean, this is also about regulating your property, though, right? So this is about revenue, but it's also telling you, because this is what they were negotiating with Airbnb, here's how many nights you're allowed to make your residence available for Airbnb. Here are the restrictions. So they're essentially the city's homeowners association telling you what the rules and regulations are for the use of your private property. That, to me, is the larger problem, even in addition to the hotel tax surcharge they're adding to the Airbnb.
Yeah, the number of nights you should be able to rent out your house is 365 a year, right? It's none of their business. And I'm reading here that one of the other regulations that they proposed was having Airbnb submit a list of addresses of hosts to the alderman of a particular ward. That is creepy as heck. There is no reason they need this list, right? What, are they going to come welcoming to the neighborhood when I check in? It's not like I can vote for them.
I don't think they're going to welcome you, no. I think they're going to monitor. But it's also, this is the whole system of Chicago, and people, I guess, have some understanding of this. But it really is, it's like a Game of Thrones episode. It is feudal lords and serfs. And you could have a seven-figure property in Lincoln Park, and you'll be reminded at some point that you are still just a serf, no matter how much money you have, no matter what your property looks like, from the smallest person to the biggest person, you know, except to the extent that you have political clout, like you fund the feudal lord's campaign or something like that, then you're treated a little bit differently. But that's really what it is. It's reminding everybody that you exist only as a result of my beneficence.
Absolutely. So the upcoming line would be, that's a nice Airbnb you got there. Oh, by the way, I'm having a campaign fundraiser over there. You might want to drop by, right? I mean, why else would you want a list of hosts for your area?
Right. And so that the tracking, like the registry list of, you know, who's staying, so that we know you're not exceeding the number of nights that we've allowed, and you're not bringing an undesirable element into the neighborhood.
I'm very undesirable.
Perhaps, right? I mean, it really is Big Brotherish, and it's all done in the name of, you know, protecting the neighborhood and zoning and all of these other false predicates for control and for revenue. And of course, revenue is just another means of control.
Absolutely. And you know, it's such a shame because I told you I stayed last night in Pilsen. I got a recommendation for a local cafe to go enjoy a great breakfast. And, you know, had I been in the hotel district, I probably would have eaten on property and not really seen any of real Chicago. This is an amazing opportunity to experience real neighborhoods, meet great people, and yet they're trying to get away of it. It's just a shame.
It's a simple solution. I don't know why Airbnb didn't figure it out. Just give Ari stock options. On this edition of Illinois Rising, it's been Dan Proft and Christina Rasmussen, Executive Vice President of the Illinois Policy Institute. Coming up next week, more of the evil that lurks in the hearts of the politicians of Illinois.